you could have any high spots or low spots in the 30 years that stand out in your mind in connection with research or people or grants or university affairs or national events that might have influenced your research?
I can't say that there are any great undulations of productivity or of inspiration. We haven't made any classic, gigantic steps such as, for example, Gobindkhurana's elucidation of the genetic code or his synthesis of a gene. We've been much more modest in our achievements, and that has been highly interesting going on, but never anything that is really world-shaking. We have made many contributions that are of a fundamentally important nature. For example, the discovery of respiratory control in mitochondria was a very exciting time, and the discovery of the inhibitors of oxidative phosphorylation, such as oligomycin, the discovery of the calcium ionophore A23187. But there are always problems in progress of this type, so that there was always something to be enthusiastic about.
Is that a disappointment? Can you hope that maybe there will be a big breakthrough? Or do you, when you take a problem, do you realize that it's not going to be have a Nobel Prize winning result?
I think that one cannot plan his research with goals of that magnitude in mind unless you have some exceptional talent. And I don't think that I have such exceptional talent. I just like interesting work. We have fun at our work. Perhaps that's not very good to tell the agencies that support you, but everything that we do is enjoyable, and we haven't ever undertaken a project that involved just horrendous amounts of detailed work where the goal was fairly well defined. We usually are exploring things where the goal is not very well defined.
Did you change direction at some point? For instance, in the 60s, you were getting into gluconeogenesis. Is that a change from what you've been doing before?
Yes, it is. Initially, we were interested in all aspects of intermediary metabolism and of phosphoryl transfer reactions as they relate to bioenergetics in living systems. This stemmed from our original work with spermatozoa when I was a graduate student, and I think it was in part inspired by Marv Johnson's teaching. We sought the purification of phosphoryl transfer enzymes, and we purified and crystallized many of these enzymes in our laboratory. And then in about 1948, we began to work on what was eventually mitochondria. We worked first with homogenates and then with isolated mitochondria, and became interested in the problem of oxidative phosphorylation. And while working with mitochondria during that period of the 50s, we became interested in the mitochondrial synthesis of phosphoperuvic acid, which had been reported in two different laboratories, by Mudge and by Lippmann. And in attempting to repeat that work, what I was really interested in is how a phosphorylated compound could come out of the mitochondria, a phosphorylated compound such as phosphoperuvic acid. I found that I could not demonstrate any synthesis of phosphoperuvic acid, and checked very carefully my protocols against those in the literature, and the only difference I could see is that I worked with rat mitochondria, whereas the other two investigators worked with guinea pig and rabbit mitochondria, respectively. And when Robert Nordley came as a postdoctoral fellow from the University of North Dakota, I informed him of the experiments that I had done and asked him to look into the differences between these two species. He then did work with guinea pig mitochondria and confirmed what was in the literature, and looked at the distribution of phosphoenolpyruvate carboxykinase in various species, and found that in the rat it's all in the cytosol, and guinea pig and rabbit there is some of the enzyme in the mitochondria. That led us then to beginning our work in gluconeogenesis, because that enzyme is the first committed enzyme in the process of glucose synthesis in animal tissue. And we've been pursuing gluconeogenesis and its regulation ever since. That occurred about 1963.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't suddenly a new problem, it really was an outgrowth
right.
deal.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any burning question that has motivated you in your... the example I would take is Folke Skoog, who apparently inspired his students with the question, what makes things grow? That's what somebody told me that he seemed to be pursuing that. Is there anything like that in behind what you do?
There is, in the sense that we're interested in regulating metabolic processes, and I'm interested in all aspects of metabolic regulation. I don't have a single burning issue that I'm pursuing. I think it's interesting to know how hormones work. It's interesting to know how enzymes function and how they regulate themselves with various effectors such as substrates and cofactors and allosteric regulators. It all interests me, and I don't think that I have any great burning desire to find one particular mechanism.
It all seems to be directed toward medical problems and possibly the cure of them. Is that something that's in your mind?
I think any scientist should have practical application of his findings in mind. If I think it's best to pursue any practical problem at the fundamental level. That is, you're much more likely to find answers to practical problems by doing basic research than you are by actually working on the disease that you intend to cure.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, we look at basic research, but we always have in mind the possible application of our findings and other people's findings to the practical treatment of disease. For example, in the case of gluconeogenesis, we're interested in knowing how it might apply to the treatment of diabetes.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't that you had somebody who was diabetic or died of crib death and you thought, I wonder how
no,
this happened.
No.
Well, let's talk about your work in the institute, and I would be interested to have you describe how you felt and what you were expecting when you accepted the directorship in 1950. Yes.
I don't think that there was any particular feeling of elation about going to the Enzyme Institute when I was asked to do so. At that time, the Enzyme Institute didn't have a particularly glowing reputation. And it seemed to me to be one of the duties. It was just going to be another laboratory where I and my students would work. And I don't recall that it was considered any great trophy. I was pleased to be asked to come over here. But perhaps I I don't plan my life well enough. I sort of just adapt to events as they occur. At any rate, once we did come over here, it proved to be a very fruitful laboratory, because there was more space available than there would have been for a professor in the biochemistry department. And I guess even as an associate professor over there, I had been expanding into nooks and crannies where no one had ever worked before because of the number of students that I had.
Why did you have so many?
There were always interesting problems to take up, so when new students came along, I couldn't resist hiring them.
How does that work? You get a certain number of applications in the biochemistry department, and you say, well, I'd like to have at least 10 of these?
In those days, the applications came to the office, and individual professors could write directly to any student and offer a position. Now, that no longer applies. Now the students come in, are recruited by a committee, the applications come in. They're recruited by a committee, and after the students are here, they work for 1 month periods in each of several laboratories, and after about 3 months of those rotations, as they're called, the student decides who he would like to work with, and so indicates to the committee, and the professor indicates who he would like to have in his laboratory. And one student is assigned to each of the professors that wish to have a student. If there are more, some professors can take two. Some professors choose not to have a student come in every year. And some professors prefer not to have any students at all. So in those days, if there was a promising applicant and you had the research funds to support that applicant, you probably would offer the student an appointment if you had laboratory space. And I expanded not only into a laboratory adjacent to the one that I had originally been assigned, but also into one of the student labs where we had two or three students working on very crude benches that were originally designed for student teaching about the turn of the century.
So your students didn't have any choice there. Did you ever fight over students if there was a very promising one?
Certainly not. No. I wouldn't have anyway. I would have certainly deferred to more senior professors.
You were the younger one. But over here you have had postdocs. You say you brought your students with you.
Well, the graduate students that were working with me at the time came over, and one of them, Gerhard Plaut, who had just finished his degree, was the leader in the move. He moved over on July 1st, whereas I didn't get over here until September. And he began his research with one of the other students during that first summer of 1950.
And after that, how did you go about, you would have had postdocs applying to come here?
Yes, there were applications from overseas and from American students, and the selection in those cases was always on the basis of merit, and occasionally on the basis of a previous student recommending the postdoctorate fellow.
You said you always have fun when you work. Would you turn down a student that you thought might be too serious? Or?
Oh, certainly not. Being serious can be fun. No, we have never had any problem getting along with a student. I know that there are many incompatibilities between professors and students that you could cite on the campus and in the biochem department too. But I've never had a student that I couldn't manage to get along with.
I can imagine that.
It's easy if you're adaptable and you see the merit in the student. Most students who aspire to graduate study have some qualification that really makes them worth developing. On the other hand, we have had a few students that were hopeless. We've had one drug addict. He was hooked on amphetamines. We've had one who was an alcoholic. And I had one very briefly who was a cheat. He faked his data, and I suspected it right from the beginning, and he just disappeared. He knew he was being found out.
How long did it take for you to find that out?
About 2 months.
Hector DeLuca said that when he came, he didn't know how to write, and one of the things he learned from Steenbuck was how to write. Was that something that you had to struggle with?
I think that that is something you learn only from your professor when writing manuscripts for publication. It isn't something that's taught in the classroom. However, when I was a graduate student, there was a very good course taught by Perry Wilson in the bacteriology department on writing and English expression. Unfortunately, I was so parochial that I never knew about this course until I was an assistant professor. Our professor, Paul Phillips, didn't encourage people to venture very far away from home base. We were always working 20 hours a day, if possible. The first day I came to Madison was, I arrived here about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, went in and spoke with him, and he said, well, we'll begin work in the morning. And the morning was 7:30, and at midnight, we were still in the lab, both professor and student. So he worked hard, and he expected his students to work hard, and we didn't move around into interesting courses in other departments. I regret very much that I didn't take more chemistry, for example. I should have taken Perry Wilson's course. I never knew that there was such a person as Aldo Leopold on the campus, even though he was here all during that period of graduate study.
Yeah, that is significant. To pursue the writing, have you had to train your students how to write then?
Yes, I think I have been pretty much self-taught on writing. I must have written very badly as an undergraduate in college because my grades in English were not very good until the last course I took in English was a composition course, and my triumph was a long-term paper on bird migration, which received high praise from my English teacher. And I wrote the story on bird migration very much as I would have written a scientific paper. As an undergraduate, I did write a classic paper for Du Bois and Moxon with their data. I wasn't a co-author. I just wrote up their paper for them. And because of having read a lot of scientific papers, I knew what should go into them. And it was published, I think, almost exactly as I had written it. Now, in later years, I learned a great deal about English usage from my wife, who is a good scholar, and probably her influence on my English had as much to do with writing ability as anything.
So you take your papers to her, you mean to actually
read
them?
No, I've never, I just
you mean just talking?
Ask her about usage and style and so on, but I've never had her read any of my scientific papers.
Well, so what about training your own students to write? Was it something you paid any attention to?
Well, I always criticized their work and showed them how things should be done and have revised in such a way as to make the writing more concise and hopefully more accurate. And yet I don't think I've ever sat down with a student and discussed the manner in which a scientific paper should be written. By the time a student gets to writing up his research, he should have read enough good scientific papers to know more or less what goes into the preparation of a manuscript. But once they have prepared a rough draft and brought it to me, I will certainly edit it and in some cases, rewrite it completely.
So what about, what was your working day like here, or has it changed? What was it like to begin with?
Well, it varies a great deal depending on the size of the enterprise. When I've had many students and postdoctoral fellows, there have been periods when the only thing I could do would be to confer with each of them and to correct their manuscripts and keep reading the literature and to dig up interesting problems for them to work on. At other times, when things are going along very well and there's something that I can do, I like very much to be in the laboratory. This summer I'm back doing organic syntheses, which is an interesting thing to do because one can devote varying amounts of time to it depending on other interruptions. If one is doing an enzyme purification, you have to stay with the problem until you reach a place where you can put it aside, whereas in most synthetic work you can do an hour's experiment and then break for other duties and then come back to it at a later time in the day.
Well, what I meant was, do you start at 7:30 and end at 12 midnight?
No, I used to work very much harder than I do now. I used to come back in the evenings a great deal when I was an assistant and an associate professor, and even sometimes after coming to the Enzyme Institute as a professor. But I don't think I have been back more than once a month for the last, in the evenings, in the last 5 years. I do come back occasionally when there's something that is needed to be done, but you can usually take the necessary work home with your briefcase. And almost invariably I do read journals or write or do something in the way of science in the evenings.
Your students might be here, I suppose.
Unfortunately, not as often as you would like to see them here. The tradition of evening work is less and less prevalent. I was very much impressed when I first came to Wisconsin as a junior in college. Our professor at South Dakota brought a carload of boys. I think I mentioned this to you before. We arrived in Madison about 10 o'clock in the evening and we went up to the animal room, and this was just shortly after nicotinic acid had been discovered as the cure for pellagra. The animal room was absolutely humming with students feeding dogs, injecting dogs. There was all kinds of activity at that hour. It looked to me as though there must have been about 20 students around in the animal room. And this tradition continued. When I was a graduate student, we worked every single evening. And in more recent years, when more students tend to be married than was the case in those days, there's less and less evening work. But I still have a group that does their most inspired work from 6 p.m. until midnight. We have three men and a woman in the lab now, all graduate students, and we had one postdoctoral fellow who was in this group who is now left, and they all do their work in the evenings rather than in the early morning hours. They come in anywhere between 10 and 12 o'clock, and I'm told, and I've witnessed this, that their day ends about midnight.
Uh-huh. I've forgotten whether you did a stint in England or Germany, did you?
No, I spent a year as a postdoctoral fellow at the Banding Institute in Toronto, working with Herman Fisher, who is a son of Emil Fisher.
Uh-huh. I was, Connie Elvian was talking about their period at Cambridge and how he got to the gates at 7 and discovered they were locked and hammered away at them because nobody came until 9, and how they did their main communicating at morning tea. Do you do anything like that? Have students informally get together every day?
Not every day. We used to have a luncheon group that would eat and talk research at the same time. However, when one does liver perfusion experiments and hepatocyte experiments, you are busy from early morning until late in the day, and you can't interrupt for lunch. Consequently, our attendance was fragmented, and we haven't had noon meetings. We do have a weekly seminar. Right now it happens to be Tuesday at 4 o'clock. It has been all during this year. And at that time, students take turns reporting on their research and accept criticism and suggestions from the other students in the audience.
Now, this is just your group, or all the
groups? This is just our group. They do, of course, attend a lot of seminars and public lectures that are over in biochemistry or other places on the campus.
What about the cross-group seminars, which you said you discontinued the ones with David Green?
Yes, following a lot of arguments that arose and unhappiness with the general tone of those seminars, we retreated to our own research group meeting weekly, and we have never reinstituted any.
Even when the others came, Corona?
Well, our differences have been great. Corona wasn't interested in metabolic regulation as we were, and our group was not knowledgeable in the area of nucleic acid synthesis or the various aspects of molecular biology that he pursued. And right now we have some kindred interests with Perry Fry, but we haven't actually had a joint seminar. We have had students from his group regularly coming to our seminars last fall, for example, when we were giving our research reports. One or two of his people would come up every Tuesday afternoon.
So they knew about them?
Yes.
It's announced or anything?
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Beinert and his group don't have seminars, so we haven't shared anything with him either.
So you don't even necessarily, you don't know their students, you might not even recognize them?
Oh, I recognize them. I know who they are. They borrow our chemicals. I know all of them.
Do you borrow theirs? I mean, is that something that goes on, like the cup of sugar from the neighbor?
Yes, it goes on very pleasantly. We exchange. However, we do give more than we receive, I must say, which raises a sore point. We've had some very bad experiences on the campus in that respect.
I won't ask you more about that. What about equipment? When you came, you must have been in charge of furnishing your whole lab. Did you have plenty of money, and could you order anything you wanted to?
We had limited research grants, but Dr. Green was very generous in providing funds that came from the Rockefeller Foundation. I believe there was $100,000 given by the Rockefeller Foundation to buy equipment for the Enzyme Institute. And he had already spent a good share of that, but he allotted a certain amount to us, which permitted us to buy equipment that we needed at the time.
So you got what you needed?
Yes, we got some good spectrophotometers and a Vorberg apparatus, and I don't recall anymore just exactly which items were purchased with the Rockefeller money, but there was a very significant expenditure of money from that source for the basic equipment. Many of the items that we had bought with our previous grants were just brought over from biochemistry. There was no restriction on the use of the equipment that we had bought over there.
I gather one of the serious problems now in scientific research is that there isn't enough money going into the universities to replace old equipment or to get newly developed.
Yes, people are aware of that at the national administrative level, and they pay lip service to the importance of new equipment for research, but relatively small sums have been made available by NIH or National Science Foundation specifically for equipment. What they have done, however, is very good. They've set up a few centers for some particular technique that might be applicable to biological research. They've set up NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance centers, and they've set up, Milwaukee has one on membranes, and one on EPR, at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. So that some such funds are available, but in general, the grants haven't expanded in at a pace equivalent to the price increases as a result of inflation.
I understood that those centers equipped with special equipment really don't work because of a research lab needs something that it can use every day and can't afford to go running off to Milwaukee or someplace else.
Well, we've had people from the biochemistry department go to Pittsburgh to use an NMR machine quite regularly. I think that they were traveling at least once a week all last year.
Really?
So,
I mean, the same person?
Yes, a student, and sometimes other students from the same group. I don't think that one needs to have a million-dollar apparatus in every single biochemistry department of the United States. You can usually get by with a few key experiments on a very expensive apparatus. On the other hand, there are a number of facilities that are available that are not sufficiently used, and one of those is our plant out here at Stoughton, where more use could be made of it by biologists.
What is that?
This is the accelerator lab at between Madison and Stoughton, off the Long Lake Wabisa.
Why don't they use it?
I don't know. I think that biologists are just unaware of the availability of that facility for biological experimentation.
Is that something you've had anything to do with?
We haven't, no. We have an Helmut Beinert's laboratory amounts almost to a national center for electron paramagnetic resonance. He collaborates with people from all over the United States and in fact from overseas as well because of his skill and the good equipment that he has.
And they come here, you mean, to use it? Or?
Yes, or more often they will just send him samples of their enzyme preparation and he will do the measurements and send them the information together with his interpretation of the spectra.
How does that work? Does he charge? He obviously doesn't charge for it.
No, he's a co-author of the publications that that result.
Oh.
That's been a very fruitful enterprise for Helmut.
But I understood that something I was reading, that equipment was costing so much, and also the necessity of maintenance of equipment, that the universities were really way behind industry in the kind of equipment they had to deal with. Maybe that's not the case here because you have WARF for it.
No, we all could use much better equipment than we have. In our own laboratory, for example, recording spectrophotometers are badly needed. We have a Cary Model 15 and a Cary Model 11 to record spectra, and those pieces of equipment have been here for 25 years at least, and they need a lot of careful adjustments by Ken Johnson, our electronics technician, and they're not as precise as modern spectrophotometers would be, but we don't have the $20,000 or more that would be required to replace them.
You must have asked for it.
No, I haven't, because of knowing how short funds are in Washington. We've had no problem getting our grants renewed, but we've always been modest in our requests and haven't put any large items of equipment in. One of the advantages of working at Wisconsin is that the overhead costs are apparently less than at many universities, and the laboratories that get the grants get some of their overhead money back. And we get, I think, of the order of $50,000 annually back from the graduate school. Mm-hmm. That's distributed among the departments that are here. So every now and then we are able to buy some piece of equipment that's fairly expensive.
So that would be top priority if you did get some money back?
Yes, it would.
Well, has it hampered your research? Or is it merely that Ken Johnson, or is that his name?
Yes.
That he has to spend all his time repairing these machines? Are they good enough when he does? Well, you said they weren't.
No, they're not as precise as they might be.
So it must have hampered you.
Yes, there are. But there are always limitations to your work. You can't have everything, so you make do.
It sounds serious to me. That is, if somebody in history couldn't get the latest book in his field, why, he'd be very, very much out of it.
Well, given the amount of funds that are available, one has to decide what will be used most effectively. And we can get by with an old spectrophotometer, but we can't get by without the 30 or 40 rats that come to the laboratory every week, mm-hmm. in order to make liver cells and prepare enzymes and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we spend our money where we think it is most productive.
Does access to a computer figure in your life here in the lab at all?
Oh yes, yes. We used to use the university computer. In fact, at one time we had a terminal here. But we now have a very nice Hewlett-Packard computer that Ken Johnson has interfaced with many of the different items of equipment in the lab, such as spectrophotometers. Mm-hmm. And we get our data summarized very quickly and recorded in graphic form so that it's most readily evaluated very rapidly after it is collected. Saves a great deal of time.
When did you start using a computer?
Well, originally, must be 15 years ago, I guess, when we had a terminal here that tied into the university's computer.
Well, who got that? Did you? Were you the one who decided to
Yes,
change?
This was in our group. I don't remember anymore which postdoctorate fellow or graduate student was most responsible for it, but we used it for a period, and then when we got our own, we had a variety of semi-sophisticated calculators that you could program with various types of analyses, and finally now the Hewlett-Packard that we have meets our requirements.
And the building is modern enough so that you can get anything in you want, such as wiring or...
Oh, yes. The building is very good. It's well designed, and we have plenty of power, all the facilities that one needs.
I've been reading a set of talks given by a group at Harvard that had an anniversary a little while ago, and ideas from things they were concerned about. I don't know how your lab here compares with what Harvard has. It may be your way ahead of them.
Well, in some cases at Harvard, the buildings are sacred. They're very, very ancient and not very They don't appear to be modern laboratories, yet their facilities are excellent. They do have good equipment, and their offices are lush.
Oh. Reminds me of Van Potter's story about Elvie and going to the New York hospital and being offered a job in an office with a wall-to-wall carpeting. Did you hear that?
No.
He came back here and got down and scrubbed the floor of his office. One of the things that's evident in an early pamphlet put out by the Enzyme Institute is the lack of enough money to do long-term planning. Did that go on, that problem?
Well, I think coming to the Enzyme Institute facilitated long-term planning because we were more or less assured of continued support from NIH during the 50s and 60s. There were funds available, and we soon found that the Enzyme Institute did have an attraction for postdoctoral fellows and for graduate students, so that there was no reason that research couldn't be a long-term proposition. There were grants that needed to be renewed regularly, but we always felt confident that they would be renewed because we had the facilities available, and if one kept being productive, one didn't worry about research money. In fact, we still don't. We've had no difficulty getting our grants renewed.
Even now?
Even now.
So this specter of loss of, I mean, you're 80% on federal funds, I gather.
Yes.
Is not harassing you?
Well, it would be nice if funds were more readily available to increase the size of our grants and perhaps to get an additional grant to buy some equipment, but we're not suffering greatly as a result of any lack of funds. Our big five-year grant was just renewed this past year, January 1st, and at that time, NIH instituted a 15% cut across the board on all grants that were issued from the Institute for Arthritis and Metabolic Diseases. But about a month later, or maybe 2 months later, we suddenly got a big check, and they reinstated 10% of that 15% cut.
Hmm.
So our grant is 5% less than we expected to get.
Do you know whether that was sent to everybody who got grants, or were you among
the few? I presume it was, because those percentage cuts are universal for a given agency within the NIH.
You gave a talk in 1973, 77, to a congressional committee on appropriations, urging them not to cut them. Do you remember that?
Well, I was asked by someone in the National Institutes of Health to come and testify on behalf of the Institute for General Medical Sciences. And this was an agency that we had never had support from, so I could speak as an unbiased scientist. And our plea was that the way to solve practical medical problems is to do basic research, and that the answers will float
mm-hmm.
to the top, and that is much more productive than the direct onslaught in the case of those diseases where we don't know anything about the mechanism that is involved. And I think, for example, that more money was put into the Cancer Research Institute than was justified. They put part of that into other institutes, such as general medical science. Progress would have been just as rapid, and perhaps more rapid, in gaining information about cancer.
Mm-hmm. But this wasn't anything that was a direct appeal from anything you were interested in.
No.
Yeah. You said when you were talking with Van Potter that that Alberti had at one point decided to put less money into enzyme research and more into molecular biology. And I can see that you wouldn't like that in general principles, but was it a mistake, do you think, generally in the university's life sciences program?
Well, I don't know about the total program, but for the Enzyme Institute, it seemed to be a mistake. Gobind Khurana had just recently remodeled his floor in the Enzyme Institute, and it was very well designed for experimentation. And the plan was to tear all of that out and to make it into a large suite of offices for the management of the administrative aspects of the Enzyme Institute. I didn't think that was necessary, and I thought we should have left Khurana's laboratories intact, and we could have asked Hans Krebs to come, who was then just preparing to retire from Oxford. And I think that if he hadn't come, we could have obtained someone else who was perhaps not as distinguished, but certainly a very, it would have been an attractive area for a very good senior scientist. And we didn't get that. Instead, some less illustrious people were hired for the molecular biology department. And while we have many good people in that laboratory, there are some who have not been productive. And I think a given amount of money invested in a fifth group in the Enzyme Institute would have been more productive.
Yes. You seem to me, you're mixing up. You said that they were going to convert the lab into offices.
Yes.
Did they do that?
Yes, they did.
So not only did you lose the lab, but you lost a high-quality person, or the potential of one.
We didn't lose anyone. We were not able to pick up an additional person. Yes.
What did changing the lab into offices have to do with molecular biology?
Alberti just maintained that we shouldn't expand enzyme research, but instead we should emphasize now molecular biology on the campus, which is a noble effort. There's no reason why they shouldn't have developed molecular biology to its utmost, but I don't think that the reasoning was very sound. I think that we could have had an additional professor, and in fact it could have been a molecular biology professor in the Enzyme Institute, which we do have now.
Is the point that they would have had to add a section of rooms for the offices, or?
No, the...
These offices were to administer the Enzyme Institute,
yes,
I gather.
The whole of the old wing of the Enzyme Institute was designed to be the administrative headquarters of the Enzyme Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And I maintain that that amount of space is not needed. The business manager of the Enzyme Institute could certainly get by with one office and one secretary, and we also have a bookkeeper or a payroll expert, and he has a tiny office that would have been sufficient. The whole area is now used largely for storage.
Gosh.
And we are remodeling on this floor now to salvage some of that space for retired professors. David Green hopes to occupy a couple of the laboratories on this floor.
Is he occupying one now?
He's over in the...
I mean, he is retired, but he still comes in.
Yes, he's writing a book, and he has one technician who apparently does some experiments.
I mean, you must have appealed to Alberti personally. I suppose you went to him.
I wrote a letter pointing out that we should try to salvage the laboratories that had been recently remodeled, and I received a reply by mail. We didn't discuss it personally.
Why didn't you go see him?
Everything that needed to be said was in my letter, and
well, I assume it wasn't just you. There must have been other people who were concerned in this issue too.
I don't know that they were. perhaps we should have organized an effort to convince Alberti that we should have, we should make a serious attempt to get Dr. Krebs here. Phil Cohen was a former postdoctoral fellow with Hans Krebs, and he was negotiating with Krebs and knew that Krebs was interested in the possibility of coming here.
Hector DeLuca said that molecular biology hasn't worked out. I think that was his phrase.
Well, you mean as a laboratory? There are some very productive people in our molecular biology laboratory, and some who haven't been so very productive. But certainly the field has worked out. It's.
I meant the lab. Obviously not the field.
Yes.
I guess what he was saying was that biochemistry had been on a plateau for during the 50s and the 60s. We're getting good people, and the interesting work was being done here. And then, I guess, molecular biology. But then he feels that biochemistry is now back on top. Or is it?
Unfortunately, biochemistry has lost some of its good molecular biologists to other universities and to industry. So it is not as strong, perhaps, as it was 5 or more years ago.
Biochemistry.
In biochemistry, the biochemistry department in the area of molecular biology. But we have some very promising young people that have been appointed during the last year or two.
You still feel identified with biochemistry, you speak
of. Oh, sure.
You go over to meetings?
Always.
Oh, faculty meetings?
Yes. And committee meetings, and I serve on several committees, and go to student examinations and things of that nature.
Hector DeLuca said he'd never let you go if he'd been chairman of biochemistry in the 1950s.
He's a good chairman.
I think he felt that Elvium hadn't really paid enough attention to what was happening.
Oh, I think Elvium wanted to see that the Enzyme Institute would survive, and it looked for a while there as though it might not.
So you haven't felt hampered in anything you've been doing by the recent cutbacks, and they're really not affecting you?
Not seriously, no. If funds were as readily available now as they were in the 60s, there would be many more items of equipment and perhaps more postdoctoral fellows than we have right now. I have 7 graduate students, and I think about 4 graduate students is the right number, and with full-time postdoctoral fellows, the laboratory probably would be much more productive.
And you can't afford them.
That's right. We're paying most of the postdocs out of our own grants right now.
Mm-hmm. Have you had to lean on WARF very much for money?
No. WARF contributed the money for the first wing of the Enzyme Institute, but we haven't depended on WARF for very many things. I think about 5 or 6 years ago I got a $10,000 supplement from the graduate school to support a postdoctoral fellow to finish up his work, but relatively little money comes from WARF to the Enzyme Institute.
It's just sort of an insurance.
Right.
Has there been any? I have to clear my. There apparently is an argument for a university evaluating institutes that it sets up. Has this been done here at all?
I can't say that we've had any official visit by our peers to decide whether we're worthwhile continuing or not. We do have a campus-wide committee that administers the Enzyme Institute or supervises it, and that is the one that is now composed of Bob Metzenberg from the medical school, Marion O'Leary from the College of Letters and Science, and I'm going to shut that off. And Oliver Smithies in the College of Agriculture Department of Genetics. They are the outside advisors to Dean Bach, who is chairman of the committee. And each of the team leaders in the Enzyme Institute are also on the committee.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought that up. I did wonder how effective the committee was or how much of a role it actually had in administering or evaluating what you're doing.
They play an important role in recruiting, in deciding what areas to recruit. And in fact, several members of the Enzyme Institute have been very disturbed by the efforts on the part of this committee to move in the direction of genetics instead of enzymology. And
strong aura on that side, isn't it?
Yes. So we have bristled a little bit and have maintained our position that it's all right to bring one geneticist, but not two. In fact, one was recruited, but decided to come only if another could also be brought in.
Mm-hmm.
Which would give us three molecular biologists in the Enzyme Institute, and we have only three straight enzymologists. And we think that there is a laboratory for molecular biology on the campus, and that should develop molecular biology, and that we should continue to develop enzymology.
So the committee recruits, but does it do anything else?
Not a great deal.
Should you be evaluated, do you think?
I think that at Wisconsin, we've never felt the necessity to be evaluated.
Well, you wouldn't, but I mean...
At this school, there is so much freedom on the part of the faculty that I guess perhaps we would resent having somebody come in and look over our shoulder and telling us that we were or were not doing good research. I wouldn't object to it by any means, but I don't think we've felt the necessity for it.
Oh, well, put it this way, there are other institutes on campus. Do you think that maybe some of them might profit from being evaluated?
Well, at many schools, deans or presidents or chancellors will decide that Department X is not very productive, so that we should bring in a team from outside the campus to evaluate their research program. And this is done very extensively at some smaller schools. And in many cases, the reports are shocking. They will condemn large segments of the faculty and make suggestions as to what needs to be done and so on and so forth. I think that that happens whenever you don't have a productive group of faculty members, and perhaps under those circumstances it's justified to do so. In any department where publications are appearing regularly in refereed journals, not the little squibs of data that appear in the quickie journals, which most of us detest, but substantial papers in refereed journals are a good indication that there is productive research going on.
Mm-hmm. There's the final suggestion that sometimes an institute should, in effect, commit suicide. That is, that its work is no longer of high priority, or that the field has been thoroughly explored and there's no need for it. Can you see that that might be the case in some research institutes?
I can't think of an intellectual area that is deserving to commit suicide. This happened more or less in our biochemistry department, which used to be world famous for its nutrition research. And during the 50s and 60s, the department ceased to be a nutrition department with the exception of one or two professors. Nutrition as a science was so important that the College of Agriculture decided to create a department of nutrition. And this is thriving at the present time. I don't know how great their research is, but it's certainly possible that enzymology will no longer need to be emphasized at some time in the future. But at the present time, it's a very active and the field is contributing importantly to both basic knowledge and to practical problems. Is it?
Yes.
Still going?
Yes.
Well, during this...
To describe that.
In 1950, McCarthy was about to campaign for re-election, and it was quite clear that he was a demagogue to some of us. I think at that time many people were afraid of him because of his power. And while he was carrying out these practices of condemning liberals as communists, we decided here in Madison to organize Citizens versus McCarthy. We had a small group, I think maybe four or five of us met to discuss this, and eventually we got perhaps 10 or a dozen people to sign a petition, and we published a full-page ad in the local papers condemning McCarthy. It was very unpopular at the time. We succeeded in getting a few distinguished physicians. Lowell Frauchi was one of our signatories. Dr. Wellwood Nesbitt.
On 6/28/83 of the McCarthy period.
When
the Progressive published
an issue devoted solely to McCarthy. I took a large bale of these magazines to the Federation meetings in Atlantic City and sold them on the street. And they went so rapidly that I phoned back to have another batch shipped and sold those as well. And we were very active in many areas. We tried to raise funds to support Tom Fairchild as McCarthy's opponent. However, McCarthy was re-elected, and eventually Tom Fairchild went on to be a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It was 2 years later that Joe Must Go was organized by the man who started Wisconsin Trails at Sauk City. And then the famous hearings in Washington at which the military was being interrogated by Joe, and Joe was being interrogated, and eventually this led to his downfall, of course, but it was quite apparent to anyone who wanted to think about it that he was a demagogue right from the beginning, and was a shallow person.
Were any of the other of the five faculty members?
Yes, there was Malcolm Gordon from the Department of Physiological Chemistry. I don't think there was anyone else from biochemistry that I can recall. I don't know if Van Potter was a member of Citizens versus McCarthy.
No,
he wasn't, no. We had a few local physicians,
mm-hmm.
and a few businessmen.
So it wasn't, no other faculty people? At the very first.
Yes, Willard Hurst from the law school.
I was wondering if he might
was
have been
a member.
Uh-huh.
I recall that.
Connie Elvium said that Connie Elvium had bawled you out on the train station because you had a sticker on your suitcase, and he thought you shouldn't bring politics into scientific meetings.
That
but
must
you
have
don't
been on the way
that.
To the Federation meetings. I don't recall it, but. I don't imagine he was very angry about it. I know that at that time there was a great deal of pressure on the university to institute a loyalty oath, and Fred resisted that. And I was told by Carl Link that the American Legion had brought a list of known communists to Fred, asking him to discharge them, and both Link and I were on that list.
Mm.
I wouldn't know a communist from a Republican.
Actually, apparently the story is that he called up Middleton and said, what would you do if I asked you to sign the loyalty oath? And Middleton said, I'd resign.
Yes, I heard that. Yeah.
What my question was, it was, have you gone on being interested in conscious of or active in national events or policies? Or,
oh, yes,
has
certainly.
Has it in any way affected what you've done in your research?
Well, I don't think so. We have participated in fundraising for candidates. At one time I was treasurer of one of Gaylord Nelson's fundraising efforts many years ago when he ran for the Senate. We've always supported good candidates.
Yeah. I was thinking of things like the concerns about pollution and population and that sort of thing, whether you would...
Half of my annual contribution to the university's charity drive goes to Planned Parenthood. We're very conscious of the importance of population control. And our research in sperm is always aimed in some manner or other at the possibilities of developing better control of fertilization.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
We're very much concerned about pollution. We have two farms at which we exclude herbicides and insecticides whenever possible.
Okay. I realized an important question that from my point of view is whether you were aware of the struggle of the social sciences to get funding from WARF and whether you were sympathetic with it. You know, the money had been going into the...
Yes, this was, I believe it was Connie Elvium who lifted the ban against support.
No, it wasn't, but...
Wasn't
I mean,
it during his administration as president that money from WARF became available?
Well, to some extent, it didn't really break open until later. But I'm curious about your own feelings about it, whether you were aware of it or concerned about it.
I was aware of it. I know that a few years ago I was aware also that history gets more money from the graduate school, money that originates with WARF, than any other department on the campus. And I know that there are many people in biochemistry who feel that the majority of the money should go to those areas in which the royalties were earned.
Do you?
But no, I don't believe in that. I think that it's not possible to raise funds in through scholarly work in most departments of the university. So I think that if there are patents that are lucrative and the funds are brought into the university administration should decide where the funds are needed. In fact, many years ago when I was, I think it was before I moved to the Enzyme Institute, I wrote a letter to the then dean of the graduate school, I don't remember who it was, suggesting that no WARF money be made available to people in biochemistry, because adequate funds were available from the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health, and that the WARF money should be available to those departments that were not supported by the NIH. And there are many departments that met those criteria. That is, there just weren't categories in Washington to support their research.
Were you thinking of places like chemistry, physics, or geology, or were you thinking of social sciences?
Social sciences, chemistry, and physics are eligible for funds from NASA and the National Science Foundation.
When did you say this? You said it was when you were an assistant professor?
Well, perhaps associate professor. I think it was during...
So it would have been Elvium.
While I was still in the biochemistry department.
Elvium or Baldwin, it would have been.
Yes.
Well, I suppose that's very interesting. good for you. You must have known of Van Potter's Committee on the Future of Man.
Yes.
Interdisciplinary. And were you interested in it? Or?
Interested, yes. Not to the same extent that he was, but I wasn't asked to participate and didn't participate. I think endeavors like that are important. One must be careful, however. If you're a natural scientist and move into an area like that, there's a possibility of being more naive than you really realize, and not necessarily contributing a great deal to the field. For example, Wilson at Harvard has opened a new area called sociobiology, and we're very interested in this possibility, but it looks as though he is being pretty well taken apart by people who are more knowledge in these areas than he is. And I think that it's all right to explore these possibilities, but to declare them as new areas of endeavor and to indicate that you have some new insight that previous scientists haven't is pretty dangerous.
Is there anything you can think of that we've missed?
Well, there are thousands of things we've missed, but I don't think they're important enough to record.
All right. Well, thank you. I hope that the university is going to give me a new tape recorder. I'm requesting it tomorrow. This is a continuation of the interview with Henry Lardy. It's February 28th.